Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. This month, we're going to spend some time talking about pensions and politics, specifically in the area of Social Security benefits and more specifically Social Security benefit offsets for folks who have government pensions. Then we'll check in with our progressive DAs or what's left of them. And that's before Elon Musk gets a hold of them. So we want to talk a little bit about what he may have in store and how that may affect our law enforcement folks out there. And finally, we're going to talk about two recent cases, one involving DAs and Brady issues out of New Hampshire, and another one that answers the question, how much work is too much and what really can an officer do about it? All that and a check-in on all things LRIS when we return. So welcome to First Thursday.
Our 2025 seminar schedule is set. We'll be conducting customer favorites like the rights of police officers and public safety union leadership, as well as two on collective bargaining, one in Nashville and another in Las Vegas. We're also excited to introduce a new union seminar called Enforcing the Contract, Enforcing the Law. Visit our website at LRIS.com/seminars2025 for more details.
First up, LRIS, what's going on? Well, we just got back, not just got back, but before the holiday, we got back from Las Vegas where we did our discipline best practices seminar this year with a focus on privacy and speech. It was a really good seminar, 2.5 days. Lots of management people, about 60-40 union side, management side. We love it when it's that way because we have some really good discussions. And the whole point is let's get good investigations so that we have solid outcomes. We're going to do that again in November. We do that every November. We'll be doing it this November in Las Vegas with some new cases and some new tweaks. Hope to see you there. If you want to learn about that seminar or any of our other ones, just check us out at LRIS.com. The next seminar that we have coming up is in February, from February 5th to the 7th. That's our union leadership seminar. That's where, you know, normally we have lawyers talk at these things and they're really good lawyers. And, you know, I think they're really interesting and helpful. But, you know, we have actual real people, union leaders who talk at our union leadership seminar about their successful approaches to running the union, to negotiating contracts, to enforcing the contract, messaging, political activity, all of the things that successful unions are doing, police, fire, and corrections all across the country. And so we hear from people who, you know, I think are really the thought leaders in the industry and check in with them and hopefully learn from their experiences. So we're going to do that one in February. Still time to sign up. Check it out at the website. We'd love to see you there. And then something you don't have to leave the house for, you don't have to leave the station for, maybe not even patrol vehicle for. And that's December 11th. We're going to be doing a webinar, a live webinar on Brady and Giglio issues. That's a continuation of our webinars on discipline procedure issues. We talked about Weingarten rights earlier in the fall. Then we talked about Garrity. Now we're going to get into Brady and Giglio. It's called Truth and Consequences, the Brady Giglio Rule for Police Officers and Law Enforcement Agencies. So that's a 1-hour live webinar. It's going to be on December 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. Check it out at lrs.com/webinars. And if you want to check out any of these events or any of the other stuff that we got going on, check us out at lrs.com. Okay, let's get to substance. And as I promised, we're going to talk about pensions and politics, or maybe politics and pensions. I always forget which order that comes in, but we've had some pretty interesting developments. I'm sitting here recording this podcast in early December of 2024. And the next time I record one of these podcasts, we're probably going to have an answer on whether or not the Social Security Fairness Act is finally passed. You know, by way of some background, if you come to our seminars, you know, we talk about this stuff and recruiting and retention is all of the rage, right? It's what we talk about at seminars. It's what everybody seems to be talking about, especially in law enforcement, but also in corrections and fire, where public safety agencies are struggling to get new people into the industry and to keep them. Well, in, I guess, this time last year in the fall of 2023, the U.S. Department of Justice released a report focusing on law enforcement agencies and the, you know, what they called a crisis in recruiting and retention. And they gave a host of suggestions. Some of them we like, some of them we don't like. The things that I don't like personally are lots of lowering standards. You know, let's get more people into the industry. And you know, what we've seen in large agencies, you know, when I talk to people at seminars, is all that means is we're just bringing people in and they're not making it through probation, or like they're barely squeaking through and now they're a problem. And, you know, that's probably not the way to grow things. When you talk to people, you know, people want higher standards. You know, and if we make these jobs hard to get, you know, and we set the bar high, you know, that will go a long way, I think. And actually it could be counterintuitive to employers, but you know, if we raise those standards, you know, we might do better in recruiting. DOJ disagrees, but DOJ also talks about in their report, ways to improve compensation and benefits. And one of the things that they recommend, that it was notable to me because we really haven't seen anything like it in the last decade or so, was DOJ said, you know, one thing we can do if we want to help recruiting and retention is we can give people better pension benefits, you know, or we can give people better retiree healthcare benefits. Gosh, we haven't heard, you know, anyone who's not on the union side of the table say anything about improving pensions or other retirement benefits for the last long time. I'd say probably the last time we spent any meaningful time talking about pension issues generally across the country was in the wake of the Great Recession. So 2010, 11, 12, where we were playing a lot of defense and trying to protect defined benefit pensions where they existed, and also trying to protect retiree healthcare. So I think on the union side, groups have been playing a lot of defense for a long time. And it was interesting to see the federal government recommending improvements in retirement benefits. One indirect improvement that is a recruiting retention benefit that wasn't addressed in DOJ's study, but it is true nonetheless, is an improvement that could be made to the Social Security system in eliminating provisions that unfairly reduce Social Security benefits for people who have a government pension and don't otherwise participate in Social Security. The two provisions are called the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. And God, the windfall, I've been doing this for, God, 25 years. The windfall elimination, people hate the windfall elimination position because it's not a windfall, you know, that was eliminated, and it just drives people nuts. But what is the windfall elimination provision? And I guess if we go all the way back, what's Social Security? All right. I'm not a pension lawyer, but I spend a lot of time on this stuff. Social Security is basically a defined benefit pension, right? For everybody, or for mostly everybody, for most employees, you know, who work in the country, they're going to participate in Social Security, which means they're going to contribute from their paychecks to Social Security. And so is their employer. Right? Their employer is going to contribute as well. And at some point when they become eligible, and the earliest you can become eligible is going to be age 65. It's going to be later for some younger people like me. You're going to receive a monthly benefit. Sounds like a pension. Sounds like a defined benefit pension. And that's exactly what it is. It's a defined benefit pension for everybody. You hear every so often hand-wringing and concerns about a crisis of the Social Security fund, and it's going to go bankrupt, or it's going to run out of money, or liabilities are going to exceed the money. You know, that's been a drumbeat since you've had Social Security. There have always been concerns that Social Security is going to go bankrupt, and it hasn't ever. And from time to time, you do make changes. How is Social Security funded? It's funded by contributions from employees and from employers primarily. And, you know, how are you going to save money if you want to make the system look more solvent? What do? Well, I guess you increase contributions either by employees or employers, or you adjust benefits. When I say adjust, I mean reduce benefits. And you usually do it for new people entering the system. It's tough for elected officials. As much as they want to see cost savings, it's hard for elected officials to vote to raise people's taxes towards the Social Security benefits or to reduce their benefits that they're getting. And they certainly don't want to do both at the same time. And so it's very difficult to get a Social Security reform bill through Congress. I think it's difficult to get anything through Congress these days. But Social Security is basically that. It's a defined benefit pension system. Now, for a lot of public safety workers, for a lot of government workers, you work for employers who don't participate in Social Security. Some do, right? And some of our listeners do. They participate in Social Security, but some don't. And no individual officer or firefighter or correctional officer gets to decide that. It's not like you get to make a decision when you start working for the employer. That decision was made a long time ago, generally. And you either work at a place that participates in Social Security or you don't. But many public safety employees work in a system where you're not participating in Social Security. The good news, you're not getting 6% pulled out of your paycheck to go towards Social Security every week. And the good news for your employer is they're not sending their 6, 0.2% towards your Social Security benefit either. What's the bad news? You don't get squat when you retire. So no money's going in and nothing's coming out. And, while most people look at Social Security as what it's supposed to be, it's like this security blanket, the last resort. Right. I might have a pension at my job, or I might have a defined contribution system, and or maybe I've socked away other money. There's lots of concerns about security there, but for sure, at least I know I've got some Social Security. It's going to be a small benefit, but at least I've got that. Right. Well, if you work in a system where you don't participate in Social Security, you don't have that. And that's why when we talk about so-called pension reforms, when employers or legislators, whether if you're in a statewide system, look to reduce pension benefits. We on the union side of the table do a lot of educating and have to remind elected officials that, hey, this is the only benefit that a lot of our retirees are going to get. They're not going to get Social Security. And so we have to be really careful before we start playing around with their DB pensions. But can't people have a side job? Right? My dad was a firefighter in Philly. They had 4 days on, 4 days off. He always had a second gig. Right. If you have a schedule that permits it, most folks are going to have some type of a second job. And maybe they're going to have a second job where they're, getting paid like anyone else and having withholding. And so they're paying into the system. Lots of teachers don't participate in Social Security and they all work in the summer, right? Have other gigs and contribute to Social Security. And, this is where the windfall issue comes in. If you work over the course of your career, while you're working for a fire department, you also are working, you name it, at a bank or something else. You have a side job that you do, and you are paying taxes and you're contributing to the Social Security system, and so is your employer, and you're earning the credits that are necessary, to become eligible to receive Social Security when you hit that retirement age. Great. What's the problem? I've paid in just like anybody else. The teller next to me, bank teller is probably a terrible example, but the teller next to me paid into Social Security and they're going to receive a benefit with no reductions. Shouldn't I receive the same benefit? Well, no. Well, whether you should, you probably should, but you don't. There are two provisions of federal law that prevent that. And one is called, again, the windfall elimination provision that just pisses people off. And it says that, hey, if you are receiving a government pension and you don't participate in Social Security through that government job, but you've earned a Social Security benefit through a second job or another job, what we're going to do is we're going to reduce your Social Security benefits. And they call it an offset. So we're going to reduce those Social Security benefits according to a formula that reflects that you have this other government pension that you're going to receive. Social Security is a government pension. So you already have a government pension. If we're going to give you a second government pension, we're going to reduce that. Is that unfair to the firefighter or correctional officer or teacher or police officer who worked their private sector job and contributed to Social Security? Absolutely. Right. So really the system gets the windfall. The benefit is reduced, but your contribution isn't reduced. And the employer's contribution isn't reduced when you're working. And so, but your benefit sure is. And so people who have earned Social Security are going to see that benefit reduced. And what's even worse is the government pension offset, and that affects survivors. So if you receive Social Security and you pass, your surviving spouse is going to receive a lesser version of your Social Security benefits, except if that surviving spouse has a government pension, They are going to see their survivor benefit reduced by two-thirds. And that can be a really significant reduction. Most of the people who are impacted by that are going to be women. I think about 75% of retirees, survivors who are negatively affected by this are women. And it can, in some instances, take the Social Security survivor benefit down to zero. So it's a really significant reduction. So we've had these two penalties, essentially, for public sector workers when they participate in Social Security through another job. And those have been in effect since 1983. So forever, right? Think about what you were doing if you were doing anything in 1983. But it's a long time. And I've been practicing since the 90s. And when I first started practicing, people were complaining about that windfall elimination provision. We got to change that in Congress and let's get rid of that. It's not fair. And my guess is every congressional session since the reform was passed in 1983, we've had bills proposed to eliminate it. And it's just one of those things that you're like, gosh, it's just never going to happen. They always try. Elected officials say, yeah, we support it. But when push comes to shove, they just don't do anything until this most recent session of Congress. So, what happened in the current legislative session? Well, earlier this legislative session, a bipartisan bill called the Social Security Fairness Act was introduced in the House of Representatives by two co-sponsors, one Republican, one Democrat. Right, that's by design. So let's call them out because they did the right thing. Rep. Garrett Graves out of Louisiana, a Republican, and Abigail Spanberger out of Virginia, a Democrat, were the two primary sponsors of H.R. 82. And what H.R. 82 did was pretty simple. It just completely eliminated the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset. Poof, they go away. If that bill were to become law, people who are affected by it now would just receive regular Social Security benefits based on their contributions into the system. So the bank teller next to me, I'm going to receive the same benefit that the bank teller next to me gets without any penalty because I, just so happened to work for a government job where there was no Social Security benefit. Is that going to cost money? Yeah. Right. It's a really big improvement. It would make a big difference in people's lives. And so there is going to be a cost impact to the Social Security system if that bill is passed. And there are different cost estimates as to what it's going to cost, but I would say about $200 billion impact, new costs loaded onto the Social Security system over a 10-year period. You may see some estimates down as low as 180, some up in the 190s. Hey, what's a few billion among friends, especially if you can print the money in the first place anyway. But it's pretty costly because it's pretty important. And that's the reason why the bill is always stalled, except this year. In fact, earlier this year, through a lot of work by a lot of the unions that do a fantastic job representing public safety personnel, and I don't want to name one and then forget the rest, and so you know who you are, but lots of great work in Washington, got a lot of supporters, a ton of bipartisan support to get the Social Security Fairness Act done. And earlier in the fall, the supporters of the legislation were able to get a discharge petition passed in the House, which essentially it's a procedural move that forces a vote. Lots of bills, without getting too much into the details, but you folks who work on legislation will know this. There's lots of ways and lots of places a bill can go to die. It'll die in committee or leadership's going to decide just never to give it a vote for lots of different reasons. And that's just how the system works. There are some procedural rules, though, that can be followed to force, a vote on an issue. And that's exactly what happened earlier this year when a discharge petition was passed. I mean, I think House Rule, God, H.R. 82 had something like 300 co-sponsors, right? Tons of co-sponsors. Everybody supported this thing on both sides of the House in an election year, yes, but it had a lot of support. The discharge petition, was successful. And what that meant was that the House was going to have to call a vote on H.R. 82. And given the number of co-sponsors, you look like that's going to be a slam dunk and it's probably going to pass. And then something pretty rotten happened on election day. And, I want to mention two other names And another name from Virginia. So one is Representative Bob Good. He's a Republican out of Virginia. And another is Representative Andy Harris. He's a Republican out of Maryland. And they are, you know, two House Freedom Caucus members. They are about as far right as you can get. No taxes, kill the government, blah, 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 blah. The kind of people that come to public safety organizations and they'll say, we're tough on crime and we support gun rights and all that good stuff. But if you ask them how they feel about your ability to earn a living, they don't really want to talk to you about that stuff. And these two guys on election day, when nobody was looking, they engaged in a parliamentary maneuver designed to kill H.R. 82. It was about as big an act of cowardice as I've seen since the Colts left Baltimore way back, right about back when the windfall elimination position was passed. You can Google it. But those two guys, if you're a listener in Virginia, you're a listener in Maryland, get active politically, and Good and Harris, they gotta go. You gotta show them the door because they took an action that would harm public safety retirees and folks who are working. The good news is that they didn't get away with it. And so House leadership ultimately elected to comply with the discharge position. They held a vote. And in November, H.R. 82 passed, you know, passed the House. This is a historic thing. That's a wonderful move. But you know what? It takes more than just the House to get a bill passed. So the bill went on to the Senate, and that's where it sits. So we're in early December. The bill is sitting in the U.S. Senate. How many co-sponsors are there to this bill, you might ask? And hey, how many votes do you need to move a piece of legislation in the Senate? There's 100 senators in there and a vice president, right? So you only need 51 to win. Now, y'all know that. That's not how it works in the Senate. You need 60 votes, right, in order to get past the filibuster. So nothing's going to move in the Senate unless you've got 60 votes. And so when the co-sponsors of the Senate version of the Social Security Fairness Act, and that's Senator Sherrod Brown out of Ohio, a Democrat, and Senator Susan Collins, a Republican out of Maine, they were the co-sponsors or the primary co-sponsors of this bill in the Senate. They went to their colleagues and tried to get enough co-sponsors to indicate the bill would pass. And in fact, that's what they had. 62 senators signed on to the bill, right? We know those are yes votes, or they should be when you co-sponsor a bill. I think you might want to, you know, support it, unless you were only being a co-sponsor because you thought the bill didn't have any chance. Not suggesting any politician has ever done that. But the bill sits in the Senate. We've got 62 co-sponsors. You might say there's no reason in the world why this bill isn't going to pass. We have 3 weeks left in the year before we're done, and it should just kind of fly right through, right? Well, not so fast. nobody knows what the heck is going to happen in the Senate over the next few weeks. The first thing the Senate has to do is figure out whether they can decide to fund the government or not after December 20th. And there's some discussion there. So maybe that's all that the Senate's going to do. We're in a kind of lame duck period here after the November election before we get a new administration and a new Congress sworn in January. And the sentiment among some people is that Congress isn't going to take any action on anything other than to fund the government and maybe kick the can into the next session. Why don't you just wait another month? What's the big deal? Well, picture you're in a football game and you're up against, you know, the best defense in the league, and you got the ball down on the 1 foot line and you haven't been anywhere close. You haven't sniffed the end zone all game, you know, and there's a minute left in the first half, or there's 10 seconds left in the first half, and you're on the 1 foot line. And the question is, do you go for it or not? Do you try to score here, or do you just kind of wait? Why don't you just wait till the second half? Well, what happens in the second half? You know, you're going to have to start all over, all back at your other end of the field, and you may never get that close again. That's how legislative sessions work. You know, all of the progress, everything that's happened so far in this session will be lost. You start from scratch in January. And so there's lots of pressure to get the Social Security Fairness Act done in December. And there's lots of concern and maybe a desire among people to wait until next year and do a bigger, larger Social Security reform bill. Hey, you may have heard President Trump, or incoming President Trump, has some ideas about Social Security, and maybe those benefits shouldn't be taxed, and any number of other suggestions. Well, are we going to load all these new costs onto the plan before a new administration comes into office? So there's lots of intrigue. I don't suggest to you that I know what's going to happen. And I would suggest to you that anybody who tells you they know what's going to happen is wrong. Nobody ever knows what's going to happen in legislation, whether that's at the federal level or the state level or in your own city councils. People tell you what's going on and they just don't know. And so stay tuned. It's an extraordinarily important issue. It's an extraordinarily important moment for public safety professionals. And hopefully when we talk again in January, we'll be reporting a really big and a really important victory for folks who sorely deserve those benefits. The next item in the news that I wanted to talk about, this is like a current events podcast this month. I just don't what's going on. But there are two really important things that are happening. And I wanted to mention there was an article that was sent to me that was in the Washington Post, of all places, last week. And it was reporting on Elon Musk and progressive DAs, right? So, okay, that's a pretty interesting one. And so, you know, and specifically the article talked about, you know, Musk's, you know, recent forays into politics. Everybody knows what he was doing over the last year or so with his active support of incoming President Trump and his PAC and pouring money into all different parts of the country to get candidates who he likes elected. And that's the way the process works. One thing that Musk has dipped his toe into the waters on, and down in Texas he spent a few bucks on, is targeting progressive DAs who receive support from George Soros. And, you know, listeners to the podcast will know we talk about DA issues and Brady issues all the time. And it seems like most of the problems come from these progressive DAs, or really sometimes we'll call them Soros DAs. There's about 20 or so of them across the country who were funded by financier George Soros, who's doing the same thing that Musk did, except Soros, compared, when you look at their wealth, Soros is like, you know, he's like a piker. He doesn't have a fraction of the money that Musk has, but he has spent, you know, really smartly in Democratic primaries in larger cities or larger counties that are where, you know, the DA is generally going to be a Democrat. And so what he's done is spent a little bit of money, but enough to tip the scales, particularly in open primaries, to get the most liberal, let's say, DA candidate to be the Democratic Party nominee. And then and it's in places where generally in the general election, the Democrat's going to win. And so it was a way that, you know, good for Soros. He could figure out a way to spend to get the most bang for his buck politically. To get these progressive DAs in office. And, you know, what happens when you get a progressive DA in your jurisdiction? Well, police officers listening to the podcast know for sure what happens, right? The scales get tipped and they get skipped, you know, tipped against law enforcement officers. And really they get tipped against the communities that you're sworn to protect, and particularly the poorer communities and the Black and brown communities. They're the ones that suffer under progressive DAs. And that's why we saw a little bit, I think actually more than a little bit of a backlash against those elected officials this past November, right? And so, you know, what do we see? We get crimes not charged. We have folks, you know, pushed out of jail sooner. You know, when's the last time you went to a Target or a Walgreens or whatever to buy, you know, deodorant, and you had to get nine different people with nine different keys to let you in so you could just kind of take it off the shelves there, right? So, because criminals aren't necessarily dummies, and they know that if there's no consequences, let's just take what you can get, literally take what you can get. So how does any of this involve Elon Musk? Well, you know, we all know who he is. We all know about Tesla and SpaceX and Twitter or X or whatever it is that you want to call it. Well, you know, at some point, all of these guys, it looks like, you know, they got enough money that they can do whatever the heck they want to do, and they decide to get into politics. And so he's been pretty active in politics. And fortunately for folks on the law enforcement side of things or the law and order side of things, he's got these progressive DAs in his sights. And so he's called them out publicly, you know, for being too lenient. We've seen him do that on X. We've seen him, if you listen to Joe Rogan's podcast, he was on there. You know, bashing some of these Soros DAs and basically saying these guys are putting the rights of criminals ahead of the rights of the public. And he doesn't get too specific about, you know, attacks on police officers by these DAs, but, you know, he certainly is saying that the Soros DAs are much too lenient and soft on crime. And so, you know, he's put his money where his mouth is. He's spent a lot of money backing candidates, generally with the vision of a safer country. And this term, right, heading, you know, now that the November election is done and he's got his giant pack with a ton of money, they're looking at ways to spend. And he's going to spend in two ways. He's going to spend in primaries. He's going to spend in Republican primaries. And he's going to spend in DA races to try to get rid of remaining Soros DAs and to encourage, you know, Musk DAs, right? And so what exactly is a Musk DA will remain to be seen, but we're talking about people that, you know, think that, hey, maybe bad guys should go to jail and maybe they should stay to jail. Maybe police officers aren't all bad, right? That's kind of the idea. You know, we'll see what happens. You know, what does Musk really know about law enforcement issues? You know, who cares? It doesn't matter. You know, the guy's got a lot of money and he's going to be spending it, you know, in this area. And fortunately, right, he sees the rise in crime. He sees the sense of lawlessness that took place, you know, in lots of parts of our countries, especially our cities. And, you know, he's taking action. I think, you know, what's going to happen with this? Well, we already saw, you know, we've seen voters were probably before Musk started pouring money into it. You know, voters have started to see things the right way, right? We saw what happened in San Francisco and in Los Angeles and in Portland. You know, voters get fed up with crime and they get rid of the DA, and that's the way the process works. So we think the tide's turning, right? We think that people are, you know, finally waking up to some of the concerns raised by these progressive DAs. But now, you know, it's going to, the temperature is going to increase. Now, does that mean that we're going to have a bunch of really conservative, tough on crime DAs across the country in every jurisdiction? No, I don't think it does. And you know, when Musk dipped his toe into the water in Travis County in Texas, he was unsuccessful. And, you know, I think it's going to be difficult. And they've got to be really smart about picking the candidates that they back. And I'll tell you why. It's what I told you up front. You know, Soros spent money in Democratic primaries, in communities where everybody's a Democrat, right? The Republicans are Democrats. You know, it's just, there's no way a Republican is going to win. And that was a smart way for Soros to kind of move the conversation to the left and to get people elected. I'll give you an example. In my community, Larry Krasner is a Soros DA, a progressive DA in the city of Philadelphia, where I'm sitting and talking to you. You know, I think he's the worst DA in the country, but you know, there's lots of other people that think theirs is worse, but he's pretty bad. He ran against law and order. He ran against the FOP. And he got, I think, either 26 or 36,000 votes in a city of 1.6 million people. And that was enough to win a seven-person primary in 2017. So it doesn't take that much, right, to get into office. And once you're in, it's tough to get you out. And so, you know, when Soros says, hey, I'm going to pick off the Larry Krasners of the world just by backing a candidate, I think that's going to be tough. And so, you know, if you're a law and order Democrat, you know, who thinks bad guys, you know, hey, you should actually go to jail, and you take that Musk money, aren't you now going to be tagged as the Trump candidate or the Musk candidate? And how well are you really going to do in those communities? So I think it's encouraging. It's certainly good to have some type of counterbalance on those issues, but it will be very, very interesting to see whether or not those candidates, and we're going to have plenty of primaries coming up in 2025 where we're going to see what happens, but how they're going to be able to avoid that, you know, Musk or Trump stigma, let's say, in Democrat cities. And Trump did a lot better in the cities, but, you know, he wasn't getting majority support in those places. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. We're certainly going to keep an eye on it. And, you know, actually one of the cases we're going to talk about, we are going to talk about cases today, but one of the cases we're going to talk about really is a progressive DA issue. So stick around. Our first case comes out of the state of New Hampshire, and it's a Brady Giglio case. Speaking of progressive DAs, and I don't think we're dealing with a particularly progressive or problematic DA in this particular case, but certainly, you know, as it relates to law enforcement officers, abuse of the Brady and Giglio process is where we see DAs, progressive DAs, have the potential to really harm hardworking officers. And so that's why we spend a lot of time on it. Real quick primer, Brady Giglio stuff. The government has an obligation in criminal prosecutions to disclose certain evidence to criminal defendants in order to make sure that they are provided with a fair trial. They have a constitutional right to a fair trial. The extent of that obligation, what information needs to be turned over, when it needs to be turned over, whether it's admissible or not, is what gets litigated in every single criminal case in every part of the country. And the Brady case is what stands for the proposition that the government is required to turn this information over. And the Giglio case, a Supreme Court case decided about 50 years ago, stands for the proposition that evidence needs to be disclosed that could have some value or some in impeaching witnesses that the government may present. And so what's a police officer? Police officer is going to testify. So if the government has information that defense counsel may think would be helpful in cross-examining that police officer in a case, all right, they might be entitled to it. Or more importantly, if the government doesn't provide that information, well, now we might have a problem with that conviction, right? And we may have people who committed crimes being let out of jail. And so the impact on officers is such that if you have a DA that says, I'm going to Brady you, whether it's really Giglio stuff, how does that affect the officer's ability to do their job? And if an officer winds up on a Brady list, are they that, now and at risk of losing their jobs? Some people say, absolutely, it's a death knell for officers. Other people say, not really. I think the truth is somewhere in between. A state that actually has done a really good job with balancing these issues, and you're balancing the rights of criminal defendants with the rights of the public to see that crimes are punished, and also with the privacy and due process rights of police officers, right, whose information is being shared with criminals to be used against them in a trial, and that could impact their future employment. And so there are different ways that different legislatures and courts will approach this issue. We're going to dig way into it on December 11th for our webinar if you want to join us. But New Hampshire had a couple of interesting cases. They actually had the best case in the country, the DeShane case that was decided in 2015, in which a court permitted officers or required a prosecutor to remove officers from New Hampshire's version of a Brady list. They call it a Lawry list there. It's just a case name, specific case name. That was an extraordinary case, probably the most important case in the country until our city of Philadelphia FOP case was decided in 2022 that identified this due process right that officers have to a hearing before they're placed on a list and to a hearing if they want to be removed from a list. And that the DA who puts them on the list doesn't get the last word. We need an independent party to ring in on whether or not someone should be removed from a list or on the list in the first place. That's another big case. But New Hampshire has been pretty far along. And a couple of years back, in the wake of the DeShane decision, New Hampshire passed a law that tried to get into the details of this and tried to set standards on what information will constitute Brady or Giglio information, and what information needs to be turned over to defense, right, to try to instill some type of order in these criminal prosecutions and hopefully eliminate disputes and provide some transparency. And what I found is when there's transparency in the process, a lot of the games, a lot of the backdoor stuff tends to go away. And so this case involves John Doe. Is his name really John Doe, the singer from X? No, it's not John Doe. He's a police officer in the city of Manchester, New Hampshire. We're not using his name because that's partly an issue in this case, right? Officers have privacy rights and we don't want their names floating out there in connection with, maybe bad things they may have done at work or off duty. And in John Doe's case, he was arrested in charge of DWI in 2020. He was off duty, he was in New York, and he got a DWI. He wound up quitting. A little bit later, the city notify the AG's office that Doe should be placed on what they call their exculpatory evidence schedule. That's essentially the Brady list in New Hampshire. Different places will call it different ways. Aggressive DAs, a Soros DA may call it the police misconduct list. And I had a case where they did that. New Hampshire doesn't go that far, right? It's an exculpatory evidence schedule. Doe pled guilty to the charge. But he subsequently filed suit to have his name removed from the schedule. He said, listen, I pled guilty to the charge, but I don't believe that my name should be on this Brady list based on standards that are set forth in the state statute. Now, what was the standard that the state statute set forth? And it was whether or not the, in this case, conviction, or whether or not the action at issue constituted, quote, potentially exculpatory evidence for purposes of the law. So potentially exculpatory evidence. If you've got potential, if it's potentially exculpatory evidence, well, then you're going to be on the list. But if it's not, you got to remove the name. He was successful. A trial court agreed that his DUI conviction was not potentially exculpatory. And he was also successful when the city appealed, or when the county appealed, to the appellate court. And the Supreme Court also, and that's the decision that was issued, Doe versus City of Manchester. It's case number 22-0448. Decided just a little bit ago this year in 2024, the Supreme Court agreed with Doe and, said that, hey, our law, provides that the State Department of Justice, can voluntarily maintain a list. And here's what it says. The list shall contain all current, quote, all current or former law enforcement officers whose personnel information contain potentially exculpatory evidence. Okay, again, potentially exculpatory evidence. What the Attorney General's office argued in that case was that, well, your former DUI, a DUI conviction is, falls within that definition, right? It doesn't need to be disclosed maybe in every case or maybe even most cases, but it is possible that this DUI conviction might need to be disclosed in future cases. Therefore, it's potentially exculpatory, right? Not in every case, but could it potentially be? The statute says potentially. I understand what the AG's office was arguing there. The Supreme Court didn't buy it, though. And the Supreme Court said, look, we're hard-pressed to envision a circumstance in which Officer Doe's DWI could ever be relevant or admissible at any trial, right? And so while DWI generally reflects poor judgment in the moment, it bears no relation to the performance of his duties as a police officer, let alone his credibility. And it bears no potential relevance to a defendant's guilt, nor would it serve as a basis to impeach the officer's credibility. And so Officer Doe was successful. His name was removed from the list. He didn't get his job back, but, he'll be in better position to find employment in the future if he chooses to continue as a law enforcement officer. And so that's a really a good case. I think it was decided the right way. We talk about it because New Hampshire's got a good statute. Not that many states have statutes on the books that try to work through what needs to be turned over and what doesn't need to be turned over. They've got a pretty good template. And if you're working on a statute in your state, or if you want to work up a piece of legislation, I would suggest that you look at New Hampshire's law. Iowa also has a really, really good law on Brady Giglio issues. Okay, our last case today comes out of the beautiful state of Pennsylvania. We like to call it a commonwealth, and it's Allegheny County versus Allegheny County Prison Employees Independent Union. It's case number 112-2023 and was decided by the state's Commonwealth Court, which is our statewide appellate court. And that was the question I asked at the outset. How much work is too much? when can you just say, no, I'm working too much and you can't make me work? Well, of course, this is a corrections case. Now, we're seeing that in police and we're seeing that in fire. But we've always seen it in corrections. Why is that? Well, our officers, correctional officers who listen know. I mean, most facilities are going to run on some type of staffing ratio. We have to have ample number of officers on duty to make sure that they're safe, their colleagues are safe, to make sure the inmates are safe, and to make sure that you're not locking down inmates too much, right? Inmates are going to have their own rights to get out and to to get a little fresh air and all that type of stuff. And so you can't just keep them under lockdown 24/7. You're going to have a big civil rights suit on your hands. So what happens when we don't have enough correctional officers, right? When pay and benefits and dignity and rights aren't sufficient to keep people working or to get them to come into the industry? Well, what do? You take it out on the people that are there working. And there are plenty of correctional officers that just get what we call stuck. Right. Everyone's got a name for it. Every facility's got a name for it. But, your shift comes to an end. And if you got an 8-hour shift, you're getting ready to leave. And your sergeant says, where are you going? I don't have anybody to fill this post. You got to stay. right? And I don't care what you had scheduled, but you got to stay. You can't leave. So you're here for another 8, which leaves many officers to ask themselves, like, hey, I'm not in jail, right? I didn't do anything. I just work here. If I want to leave, I can leave. And that's true. You can leave, but you might get fired. And so the situation in Allegheny County's jail, this comes out of a jail, not a prison. It's no different necessarily than any other facility across the country that's been struggling. They don't have enough correctional officers. You get stuck in a cycle where if I've got, and I'm not suggesting this happened in this case, but if I've got something really important and I'm on, first shift, if it's an 8-hour shift operation, I've got a little league game that I have to get to, or I've got childcare opportunity. My wife works at night and I have to be home in order to take care of the kid. But I also know that staffing is really terrible and I'm probably going to get stuck and I won't be able to leave. What do officers do? They might bang off sick. And then what does that do? It makes the staffing situation worse. And you just wind up in this terrible cycle that's really, really difficult. And it's really hard to get that reversed. Money helps a lot, but there are other things that help. And so in this particular instance, this is exactly what happened. The CBA, this is a collectively bargained workforce, and the CBA between the Correctional Officers Union, and it's an independent union, and the county actually recognized the staffing issue, right? So it's nothing new. There's language in there that kind of deals with this, and there's pretty standard language in the CBA that says, hey, here when we're short, here's what we do, right? Here's how we fill positions, and usually it's the young folks get screwed. And they get called back in. But people were being mandated all the time. And there were a couple of other interesting provisions. There's a provision that says, and this is general provision that says that COs have to remain alert and be prepared to perform their jobs at all times. Okay, might be pretty vanilla language, but maybe it had some interest here. And there was also another provision that said that the union and officers had to exert every effort to ensure that shifts are properly manned at all times. That tells me, right, this is a long-standing staffing issue. There's language in the CO saying, listen, the union has to do everything it can to make sure people are coming to work, and officers really have to make sure that, shifts are, quote, properly manned. So there's a problem at the jail if you've got language like that in your contract. And so this case involves two correctional officers, Officer A and Officer B. They were both suspended for a day because they refused to be mandated. They got called in. They were already home, right? So they left the facility, but they got mandated to return to work for an overtime shift in April of 2022. Now, Officer A, leading up to that, the 4 days prior, he had worked four consecutive 16s. So he had four eights where he got pulled for another 8. So four consecutive 16-hour days. Officer B had it much easier. He only had three consecutive 16-hour days. Our correctional officers listening to this, a lot of you guys are going to be going, yup. Unfortunately, I identify. So these guys were working. Just in the quarter, they gave Officer A, I think he had 271 overtime hours in that first quarter. Officer B had also worked a lot. And actually, I know people that work more than that. It's just crazy sometimes in the jails. But so the prisons say, well, if you didn't come in, you were insubordinate, right? We ordered you in, you refused the order. This is a paramilitary organization, and we gave you a 1-day suspension. If they were that insubordinate, why did they only give them a 1-day suspension? What do you think, administrators? Because they don't have enough people to do the job, right? They're not going to fire them. They're not going to suspend them for a long time because they need all the people they get. But they do send a message and they give them 1-day suspensions. And what does the union do? The union files a grievance. So that's bullshit, right? These guys were working their asses off on 3 16-hour days in a row. At some point, they have the right to say, no, I'm not going to come in. And that's what the union argued. So the union argued, and this was a discipline case. So the jail had the burden, and their burden's pretty easy, right? They probably said, okay, here's the order that went out, and these guys just refused the order. We met our burden. They were insubordinate. Problem solved. But in the union's case, the union argued that the arbitrator should consider mitigating circumstances. And here that, the officers should not have, in that circumstance, be obligated to accept mandatory overtime just because of fatigue, right? How did that relate to CBA provisions? The union, it was a really clever argument. The union argued that if these officers showed up to work, on the day that they were called. And that would actually cause them to violate the contract because the contract says you have to remain alert and prepared to work, and they would not be. The contract also says that they have to, the union and officers have to ensure that all shifts are, quote, properly manned. That probably meant the number of people working, but the union said, hey, these guys are in no condition to be anywhere but their couch or their bed, and you know they're not able to work. And if they're there at work in uniform, that's not properly manned, right? They're not protecting anybody. Really interesting argument made by the union. And the union was successful in arbitration. The arbitrator sustained both grievances. He said that you know the county did have an interest in maintaining safe staffing levels, but the union's interest in ensuring adequate rest for the COs was more significant. And so, you know, what the arbitrator indicated was, you know, he had to really decide two things. First, did the grievance work so hard that they would have been unable to adequately perform their job duties on the mandated shift? And the second question was, you know, if so, is that an adequate reason for turning down the assignment? The arbitrator in this case concluded, you know, that not only, right, the record shows not only had they worked all these 16-hour days prior to the refusal, but they did that a lot, right? So it wasn't just a bad week. It was they had been doing that for months. And so given the risks at work, the arbitrator concluded that the officers were within their rights to refuse, you know, mandatory arbitration. And he also, you know, bought the union's argument that, you know, properly manned doesn't just mean that someone shows up to work, but that they be, you know, quote, competent to perform the expected job duties. Now, what that's going to mean, you know, on a case-by-case basis, the arbitrator said, well, I don't know what to tell you, right? But I do know that in this particular case, right, if an officer is too fatigued to work or is not in condition where if they showed up, their shift wouldn't be properly manned, that that's just going to have to be a case-by-case determination that's going to be made. But for Officer A and Officer B, absolutely they were within their rights. And the county violated the CBA by suspending them. Now, the county appealed that decision. They tried to say that it wasn't rationally derived from the contract, and they lost pretty much across the board. And the decision that we summarize, and it's in the newsletter this week, was issued by the State Commonwealth Court, which just said that, hey, this arbitration award was rationally derived from the just cause provision in the CBA, which must permit the grievance to offer genuine fatigue and genuine concern over their abilities to perform as expected as a defense to willful or intentional disregard of a supervisor's order. So really interesting outcome, a good outcome. What that means for the jail, and did they have in the wake of this a raft of people saying, I'm not coming in? I don't know. You know, if you're from that jail, you know, and you know the answer to that question, reach out to me and let me know. But a very interesting decision dealing with a pretty important issue. Okay, that's the podcast. Two current events, two recent cases of interest, and I think our job is done. If you want to hear more about this Brady stuff, join us for the webinar on December 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. And if you want to see us in person in good old Las Vegas, come on out to the Union Leadership Seminar in February 2025. Thanks a lot, everybody. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday season and a safe holiday season. See you next year.